Welcome to The Antique Show. We talk antiques, collectibles and art, and all the news and events from Australia and around the globe. Here's your host, Jason Harris.
Thank you, voiceover guy, and welcome to the first edition of The Antique Show. My name is Jason Harris, and I'm really excited. This is not only my first podcast, but this is the first edition of The Antique Show. And behind the glass, our producer and researcher extraordinaire, Mark Wave. Hello, Mark. There he is. And it's a cold day here in downtown Adelaide in South Australia. For those listening interstate or overseas, we're coming out of our studios at Grange. We're in about 300 or 400 metres from the beach, but it's a chilly one here. Around about 12, maybe 13 degrees, the sun pokes its head over the horizon. We're not here to talk about weather. What are we here to talk about on The Antique Show? Well, we are going to talk about everything to do with auctions, antiques, collectibles, everything that you've got tucked away in the back of your cupboards, maybe sitting on the shelves in the wall in the shed. We're going to go on a bit of a journey. We're going to discover some really cool things. We're going to read through some articles. We're going to go through the news and events that affect antiques and auctions both locally in Australia and also the rest of the world. So a little bit about me. My name's Jason Harris. Is our voiceover guy introduced me. What about me? So I've been in the antique and auction trade for 30 years. So 1988, I joined a small company called Theodore Bruce here in South Australia. And I started as a storeman lugging furniture around. And 30 years later, I find myself owning and managing Scammel Auctions. I also manage a couple of other websites. One of those is called Learn Antiques. And this is my passion, not only in about antiques, and about auctions, and I certainly love what I do, but I'm very passionate about educating. And part of my plan for the next few years is to really develop the Learn Antiques site, and that partially through our video, partially through what we do with our releasing of articles, but also this podcast, the podcast show called The Antique Show. So I really hope you enjoy what we've got coming up. As I said in the earlier part of my introduction, this is not only the first episode of The Antique Show, but it's my very first podcast. So we're going to work our way through and going to really develop this show out. So I hope you stay tuned. For those who are listening in months or sometime in the future, we'll be interesting to see how the first episode compares to maybe episode 100 if we get there. Okay, so what has the show got in store for us today? We're going to have a look at the news and events that affect, as I said, not only antiques and auctions in Australia, but also around the world. We're going to review some of the prices achieved at Scammel Auctions at two of our major events. We had the Gifford Collection come up for sale, which is an amazing collection of Dalton silver items of musical interest. And that was a three-day auction. We held four auctions over 3 days, and that started on Friday the 28th of June, Saturday the 29th, Sunday the 30th of June. Around about 1,200 lots. Quite an amazing event. The Giffords were collectors, 40 years of scouring through auction rooms, flea markets, antique shops, both here in Australia, and they travelled quite extensively overseas. And we saw some bills. They'd bought a pianola somewhere in Scotland for about £1,200. Now, this is in 1986 or 1985 from memory, and it cost them about £130 to have it shipped back to Australia. So the shipping cost quite cheap, but £1,200 back in 1986 was a lot of cash. Anyway, so we had this sale, huge sale, so I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. Anyway, let's open up with news and events across Australia and the world. So I really appreciate you listening, and let's see how we go. All Okay, let's go to the local news first. Now, New Zealand kicks it off with an auction of rare documents collected by Christopher Parr. Described as one of the finest collections of early New Zealand printed material, Christopher Parr's collection of original documents was set to go under hammer at Art and Objects Newton headquarters on June 26. The collection includes the Crown's Declaration of Sovereignty over New Zealand, Maori proclamations, and the first printed newspaper in New Zealand's history. Rare book consultant at auctioneers Art and Object, Pam Plumbley, said the documents are unlikely to ever come on the market again. And Sidney Nolan's Dark, Restless Landscape Antarctic 1964 reached $170,000, a new record for paintings from the 1964 Antarctica series. And this is a Bonhams winter sale after a duel between three room bidders and the telephone. And moving back to New Zealand again, a New Zealand artist helps kick off World Revival of Women Artists. Frances Hodgkins is at the top list of women artists who dominate the What's On lists of important exhibition venues around the world this year. She is the star of one of the biggest exhibitions, numbering close to 300 watercolours, and aptly titled Frances Hodgkins European Journeys, showing at the Auckland Art Gallery. This is an extraordinary achievement for an artist whose career spanned the leap that world art took from the traditional to the contemporary in the 20th century and came from a place that thought to be the end of the world. Frances Hodgkins' greatest achievement, however, was perhaps applying modernism to the medium of watercolour, in which she worked almost exclusively. An Australian flag from the World War I armistice is to be sold by Leslie Auctions at its decorative arts and collectible sale. And that was on June the 23rd. And it was a full-size Australian flag signed by Marshall Foch that went under the hammer. On November the 11th, 1918, Foch accepted Germany's request for an armistice and advocated peace terms that would make it impossible for the Germans to ever again pose a threat to France. Foch signed the flag for the Australian Army Captain George Hamilton at the Hotel Carlton in London on the same day the treaty was signed. The flag is mounted in a large timber frame. Now on to international news. Flags. Speaking of flags, the first flag on Omaha Beach is to be sold in the US, and is believed to be the first one planted on the Omaha Beach in northern France on D-Day, and it proved to be the top lot at Heritage's Arm and Armour Civil War and Military Auction on the 9th of June. The flag was planted by First Sergeant John Horvath, a bartender turned army engineer, when thousands of Allied forces stormed the beach in Normandy. It sold for a premium inclusive price of $162,500 after what the auction house described as a flurry of competitive bidding. Oh, and Apollo 11 hits the news. Another American antique, the Apollo 11 Timeline book, is going under the hammer and offered for £7 to £9 million. It is among the 200 artifacts from the NASA mission of the 60s to the 70s offered at Christie's New York auction on the 18th of July. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin kept the book between them, annotating in real time as they landed the Lunar Module Eagle. It was in Aldrin's personal collection until it was sold to the current vendor in 2007. Other highlights include a US flag flown aboard the Apollo 10 and a camera lens dust brush used on the lunar surface during Apollo 14. A camera lens dust brush. And while in the UK, a sofa featuring in the same two-day auction as a £7,000 case of Beatrix Potter ephemera found in a Cumbrian Victorian villa made national headlines when it was pitched between £70 and £100. The six-foot-wide sofa was catalogued as an Edwardian Chesterfield-style settee, having floral upholstery on tapered legs, needs upholstery, springs seem okay. That was the description. Anyway, it sold to a UK buyer for £4,400. And the painting, dubbed the Toulouse Caravaggio, could now go on show in a museum after a private sale. The painting was sold in a surprise deal from an undisclosed sum believed to be more than 30 million euros, 2 days ahead of its planned auction in Toulouse. which is estimated to go for about 100 or 150 million euro. The buyer has not been named, but agents acting for the vendor say the foreign buyer will loan the picture to the museum. The picture was deemed to be a national treasure in France in 2016 and had an export ban placed on it by the French government. While the Louvre had been given the chance to purchase the picture, it declined. And that's it for the news, both local and international. If you want to learn more about antiques, about art, about auctions, sterling silver, fine art, jewellery, pottery, china, you name it, go to Learn Antiques. That's learnantiques.com.au. There's a myriad of articles have been written there, and they're all free. You don't have to sign up, don't have to give any information. You just click away there. We're releasing some more videos shortly as well. Podcasts will be on there, but lots of articles written about all sorts of topics, including toys and cars and rugs, porcelain, Royal Doulton, Royal Winton, the whole lot there. So go online at learnantiques.com.au. Get educated. As we say, Learn Antiques, watch, learn and grow. All right, let's get our learning caps on. Part of my passion about our industry is not only the millions of different type of items that come out of the backs of cupboards and we find in sheds and things, but one of my passions is really education in our industry about auctions and antiques. And there's not a lot of places you can go. You can go to books in the early days. I remember we had to troll through books, tomes almost of photographs and try and learn as much as we could about it. But there's nothing like the touch and feel of antiques. And a part of this, I suppose, is make sure that you visit an antique shop, make sure you go to an auction room and just experience a few of the things that to take your interest, then go home and learn a little bit more about them. Anyway, as I said, part of my passion is about education. So I've set up a website called Learn Antiques, and you might have come across this podcast on Learn Antiques. If not, go to Learn Antiques, which is learnantiques.com.au. So we're releasing this podcast each week, and part of the podcast, we're going to read through some articles. And I've got some researchers from across the world who I ask to research certain subjects. And the first one I've picked is Hans Heisen. Now, Hans Heisen, and I'm going to read through the full article. The Hans Heisen is an amazing artist, 19th century, early 20th century artist. Not many people in the art industry or even on the periphery of the art industry wouldn't know the name Hans Heisen. And his works, and he's a prolific artist, his works are spread across Australia and across the world. Anyway, as I was reading through and researching for this segment, I was amazed about some of the trials and tribulations he went through, especially being a German in Australia during the First World War. Anyway, let's read through. This is a reasonably lengthy article, but bear with me. There's a lot of nuggets of gold in here and a lot of things to learn about Hans Heisen. I hope it inspires you to maybe visit South Australia. And if you haven't visited yet, come to South Australia, go up to Harndorf, which is around about 35, 40 minutes out of Adelaide, to the area just outside Harndorf called the Cedars, the home of Hans Heisen. Anyway, let's learn about Hans. Sir William Ernest Hans Franz Heisen, OBE, was born in Hamburg, Germany on the 8th of October 1877. His father Louis emigrated to Australia in 1883 before his wife Maria joined him a year later with their five surviving of six children born. From 1885, Hans attended the first East Adelaide Model School and then four different schools in the area. He was taught in both English and German and showed early promise as an artist. After leaving school at the age of 14, he worked for the sawmill and hardware company Cowell Brothers before joining his father's hardware merchant business. Hans began painting around the same time, attending night classes at the Nord Art School under James Ashton, his wages paying for his art supplies. He painted the watercolour The Wet Road in 1890. The first painting he sold, which was bought by Ashton for 10 shillings. The following year, he joined the Academy of Art, and in 1897, he became a member of the Adelaide Easel Club, both established and run by Ashton. Ashton's belief that students should have at least the basics of drawing proficiency was underscored by the inscription that hung on the wall, "He that attempts to run before he can walk must surely stumble and fall." Every year between 1895 and 1899, Hans exhibited with the Easel Club, and from 1897 to 1899 also with the South Australian Society of Arts, which was a division of the former. During this time in 1898, he enrolled with the South Australian School of Design after Australian businessman and philanthropist Robert Barr Smith paid his first year's fees. In 1899, the Royal Drawing Society of Great Britain and Ireland awarded him both first prize for a landscape in watercolour and a silver star for a drawing in charcoal. The same year when Hans was 20, a group of wealthy Adelaide art patrons sponsored him with a four-year art scholarship and study tour in Europe. The group, comprising of Dr. Henry Higham Wigg, his brother William Laidlaw Davidson and Frederick Allen Joyner, and miner Charles Henry de Rose, advanced Heisen £400 on the condition that they were given the option to sell whatever work Hans produced whilst abroad. His studies began at the Academic Calarossi and the Academia Julian. The form was established in the 19th century by Italian sculptor Filippo Calarossi, and the Academia Julian, established in 1868, prepared art students for the exam of École des Beaux-Arts. Both academies allowed female students to join and draw male nudes, something the conservative École could not countenance. In 1900, Hans extended his studies in Paris. His summer vacations were spent in Holland, Germany, England, and Scotland. He spent his final year in Capri, where he painted copies of the old masters held in churches and museums. Returning in Adelaide in 1904, Hans opened a studio and art school, reverting to painting the Australian landscapes, especially its iconic gum trees, which he was renowned for. In 1939, Hans stated, "In all stages, the gum tree is extremely beautiful, first for being a tiny sucker with broad leaves, shooting up like a fountain answering to the slightest breeze. At middle age, it becomes more sturdy, more closely knit and bulky, yet never losing grace in the movement of its limbs and the sweep of its foliage." In an article by Ross Fitzgerald, featured in the newspaper The Australian on the 8th of July 2017, author Louis Klepak quotes artist John Olson in his book Hans Heisen Set Against Australian Landscapes in Biography, released by Beagle Press in 2016. And he quotes, "Hans Heisen was the first non-Indigenous artist to tackle the landscape of Australia's interior. There he discovered trees that embedded themselves into the earth and reached so sturdily that they are like Doric columns. In a sense, they became like portraits. Yet there is nothing bohemian about Heisen. His life and work represented a stability as strong as his gum trees." Now, going back to the 15th of December 1904, he married Selma, a.k.a. Sally Bartels, one of his pupils. They went on to have eight children of their own, five daughters and three sons, as well as adopting another daughter. One of their daughters, Nora, also became a recognised artist. She was appointed as the first Australian female war artist in World War I and was awarded the Archibald Prize in 1938. This Archibald Prize was established in 1921 and continues today as an annual award. An exhibition in Sydney in 1904 saw Hans's The Coming Home, which was painted in 1903, bought by the gallery for 150 guineas. It was sold in Perth in May 1999 for $28,000 and again in November 2000, less than 6 months later, for £30,000. Now, Hans's arrangement with his benefactors left him impoverished as he continued teaching until the major success of his solo exhibition in Melbourne, which opened on the 8th of August in 1908, selling work to the value of £750. Sally encouraged him to terminate his teaching classes following growing positive publicity, including the support from Dame Nellie Melba and his close friend Sir Lionel Lindsay. Another successful exhibition in 1912, attaining total sales of £1,500, allowed the Heisens to buy the Cedars, a 60-acre property near Harndorf in the Adelaide Hills. Heisen lived there for the rest of his life, painting from a limestone studio built amongst the trees close to the home. Now, in 1904, Hyson painted Mystic Morn, which won him the Wynne Prize. The work was bought by Adelaide Gallery for £150. A charcoal drawing of the same work sold for $500 in July 1970. And Hyson went on to win this prestigious prize another 8 times. Now, Hans gravitated to still life painting in around about 1914, using flowers, fruit and vegetables as his subjects. He would paint these when he was unable to venture outdoors in inclement weather. He would not make preliminary sketches, but preferring to paint for days if necessary to capture the composition before it perished. Now, the outbreak of World War I resulted in a very difficult period for Hyson. He held a third profitable exhibition in Melbourne in March 1915, but the Gallipoli campaign had begun weeks previously. Now, at this time, anyone of German descent was viewed with suspicion by Australian authorities. Newspapers printed in German were banned and schools teaching in the language were closed. Even an account goes that students of an Adelaide university tarred and feathered a German professor. However, a suggestion that Germans who had received qualifications in Australia be stripped of these were overturned. Now, Hans's generous donations to the war effort in the form of the South Australian Wounded Soldiers Fund were met with scepticism by the authorities, who viewed this as subterfuge. Art galleries removed his works and he was excluded from one of the first retrospectives of Australian artists held in 1918. Hyson was actually a pacifist and totally opposed to the war. The National Gallery of Victoria was interested in buying the Three Gums, painted in 1915, then known as the White Gums, but were wary of doing so under the question of Hyson's nationality. After making some changes to the work, Hyson sold it to the Ballarat Art Gallery in 1921. In 2004, the same work of art was sold for $19,000 Australian dollars. Now, between 1920 and 1926, Hyson held 4 exhibitions, earning him in excess of £11,000. 2 issues of Australia in Art, first published biannually and then later quarterly, between 1916 and 1925, were dedicated to him. In 1931, he was awarded the George Crouch Prize for Contemporary Art, which was established in 1927 by MP Richard Crouch in honour of his father. In 1932, Hyson painted the watercolour The Camp on the Wanaka Creek, Flinders Ranges. It had been sold to a James McGregor in 1958, who is believed to have given the piece away as a gift. It was returned to the Australian market, where it was discovered as part of a deceased estate in Dusseldorf some 60 years later. In 2017, the hotelier James Duffield, reading the news about the upcoming auction on social media, and knew his father would be interested in it, as he used to be neighbours with Hans, the family agreed to bid on the work and despite stiff competition, successfully acquired and repatriated the work for $110,000. Now, going back to 1934, Hans returned to Europe, and in 1935, he held an exhibition at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, his first public art museum. World War II broke out in 1939, and 1940, the then board of the National Gallery of South Australia, soon to become the Gallery or the Art Gallery of South Australia, appointed Hyson as a trustee, which a position he held for 28 years until his death. There was a marked difference in attitude to the German ancestry which had caused such a furor in the Great War, the issue being largely ignored. This was exemplified when, in 1945, Hyson was awarded the OBE for service as a trustee of the Hobart National Gallery. He was awarded the Maud Vizard Woolerhorn Prize in 1957, and in 1959 he was made a Knight Bachelor for Service to Art in the Queen's Birthday Honours. The award is amongst the oldest British commendations, established in the 11th century. Hans was an early pioneer of nature conservation. He advocated for the preservation of the red and white gums of the Adelaide Hills and warned of the pitfalls of degrading the natural environment. He was known to pay local landowners and local authorities substantial sums in lieu of their cutting the trees for industrial use. Tyson is regarded as the first non-Australian to paint gum trees and other characteristics of rural life, including farm animals such as sheep, livestock, horses, and their human carers. His work was post-impressionist, evoking realism, but not portrayed photorealistically. He preferred to romanticize his subjects rather than depicting them as they truly appeared. Hyson's work can be found, or works can be found, in major galleries, including the Art Gallery of South Australia, which has a major collection personally bequeathed to them by Hans. This comprises of over 2,000 drawings, oils, and watercolors. He was also represented at the National Gallery of Victoria, the National Library of Australia in Canberra, and the Royal Collection in London. His memory lives on in Australia and in other areas than art. The 1,500-kilometre walking trail between Cape Jarvis and Parachuna Gorge is called the Hyson Trail, and one can find the Hyson Range in the Flinders Ranges, the largest mountain range in South Australia. Hans died in Mount Barker's Soldiers Memorial Hospital on the 2nd of July 1968, aged 90, and is buried at the Harndorf Cemetery. There we are, some information about Sir Hans Hyson, one of the most prolific and well-known artists in Australia, and one of the best well-known artists in the world. A watercolourist and ever-increasing value. So if you ever get a chance to visit the South Australian Gallery, do so. There's an amazing collection on display of Hyson's works. So I really hope you enjoyed that. Some information about Hans Hyson. Of course, you can read the full article at Learn Antiques, which is learnantiques.com.au.
All right, here in my buddy guitar. How much here? It's 70 dollar, not one. It's 71, one, one dollar, one, now two, two, three dollar, three dollar, four, four, 74, and pie.
Okay, let's talk about sale prices around the auction room. Now, for those who don't know about Scammel Auctions, we've been in business since 2002. We have a regular weekly sale called our Monday Estate Sale, and we normally have around about 900 to 1,000 lots. So what I'm going to do each week, I'm going to look at some of the highlights from the previous sale and just run through what the pieces were and how much they sold for. So a few surprises amongst those, but a special one this week. I mentioned earlier about the Gifford Collection, and so we'll explore some of the Gifford Collection and some of the amazing prices and amazing pieces in there. Okay, let's discover some prices from the Monday sale, which was held on the 1st of July. Probably the highlight for us was lot number 1442. It was a Bakelite radio, but just not any Bakelite radio. This was an AWA Radiolette C104, circa 1933. Now, we did a bit of research on this, and this was £22 when it was first released in 1933. Quite an amazing radio in the sense that it was really ornately designed, coming out of the Deco period, so really nice curved structure, a little bit like a rounded Empire State Radio, for those who know that. But look it up. Anyway, it's the AWA Radiolette C104. It was in overall really good condition. There's one valve missing, but there's no cracks in the case, which again is quite unusual for Bakelite radios. One of the knobs from what we've seen, not quite right, but the rest of it was in quite amazing condition. And it's quite a beautiful radio. I can imagine this in some of the more wealthier houses around Australia, sitting on the mantelpiece or on the tea table with the cricket playing. Anyway, this sold for $3,400, quite an amazing price. So look it up. It's the Radiolette C104. Moving on to other ones, and this was also quite a surprise. Now, we are not bottle experts by any means, and I know probably zero about bottles, other than they contain some really fine red wine sometimes. This was a Conlon and Co. Broughton Street Glebe, a stoneware bottle. Now, by any other measurement, this is just a run-of-the-mill bottle, stoneware, so it's got a really nice sort of caramely brown glaze on it, and as with a lot of stoneware bottles, the maker's mark is stamped around the top near the neck. Now, interesting about this is the top of it had come off and been glued earlier on, so quite a while ago, so it wasn't in perfect condition. But again, a little bit more research, and it had a very, very modest guide, so it had $50 to $100 on it. Anyway, it sold for $2,000. $2,600. Now, apparently, these bottles in good condition can get up to about $8,000. So really an amazing thing. So one of the lessons there for us and for anyone who's listening in, just be careful what you throw out. One of the things we battle quite often when we go out to estates is they say, look, we've had the family around on the weekend and we've cleaned up and we've thrown out all the rubbish. And it ends up being that the rubbish is actually worth more money than what the dining suite might be or the lounge suite. So anyway, be a little bit careful there. Stoneware bottles, $2,600 for the Connell & Co. from Glebe. And the other one, this is a personal favourite of mine. Didn't get huge amounts of money in the scheme of things, but it's a ship diorama. But what's special about this, it had a cedar trampart frame. So I'm going to challenge you to look up trampart. It's quite an amazing technique, very detailed, but it's also very naive in a lot of ways as well. And so is the ship diorama. So it was a steamship. It was made in the late 19th century, and it was about 34 centimetres high by 54 wide. A few chips and a bit of damage to the trampart frame, but a beautiful piece of Australiana, and that sold for $800. That was lot number 1459. Now, the other piece, this is a lot of local history here, the Nord Football Club frame photograph. Now, what made this special? It was from 1887, so quite early on in the history of the Nord Football Club. In a really nice maple frame. The photograph was quite clear. There's a little bit of sun damage on one side, but overall, a really nice piece, and that sold for $600. This one was quite amazing. The reason I picked this tea table out, it's a William IV tea table. Now, you probably hear a lot around the traps about brown furniture and brown furniture not selling really well, and it's true. In the past, when I first joined, I'm talking 30 years ago, joined the antique and auction industry, brown furniture or William IV, Georgian furniture, Victorian furniture, and even to some point Edwardian furniture was selling really well. Amazing prices, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 for a sideboard and a dining table. I remember going down to some antique shops and you'd buy a dining suite for $20,000 or $30,000. Well, without putting it too fine a point on it, the bum dropped out of the market for brown furniture. And we saw the decline probably around about 20 years ago and the real decline sort of 10 to 15 years ago. And unfortunately, these beautiful pieces of furniture just aren't worth the same amount of money they used to be. However, I'm starting to see, and we're starting to feel the resurgence in interest in these pieces, and we're finding probably more of the petite pieces, certainly like tea tables. Anyway, on with this one. This is a really nice fold over top on claw feet. William IV, so it's 1830 to 1836, had a really nice shaped center pedestal, and that sold for $750. So again, nowhere near what it used to sell for. They would have got $2,000 to $3,000 probably, but it's on the resurgence. We would have found maybe 5 years ago the same piece sold for a couple of $100. Okay, now we talked about the Gifford sale, or the Gifford collection. So 3 day auction, 3 days of auction, 4 auctions in total, around about 1,200 lots. So I've picked out some highlights from here, and a couple of the pieces really stood out for me. And one of these was a pair of large Royal Doulton exhibition vases, and these were in faience earthenware, decorated with foliage and flowers and passion fruits, and they were decorated by Florence Lewis around about 1888, monogrammed on the base. Really nice piece, and these were 61 centimeters high, so well over half a meter high each. Now, we had a very modest price on these, around about the $7,000 mark. They ended up selling for $6,200. Quite an amazing pair of Royal Doulton vases. The other one, which was we really enjoyed, it was a large symphonium. Now, the symphonium is essentially the jukebox or the CD player of the 19th century. So imagine this. It's quite a tall piece. So on a newer base, it would have stood probably around about 7 or 8 foot high. In the center of the symphonium is a large disc. Now, it's a 25-inch disc with perforations. On the back of those, the perforations formed little teeth. And these struck, when it went round in a circle, these struck combs and they played the tune based on when and where it struck on those combs. So This was driven not only by clockwork wind-up, but also you had to insert one penny into it. So this would have been in a parlour, like a pub somewhere, or maybe in the ground floor of a theatre, and patrons would pay one penny and would play the symphonium. This was these are quite rare on the market. Certainly this size was quite rare. This was around about 1895. The bass was reproduction, did come with 25 other discs, and this sold for $5,900. The third piece I'd like to talk about out of the Gifford collection, this again was a personal favourite of mine, and we really underestimated the value of this, and that just goes to show, despite having 30 years, you just sometimes never know where the market's going to go. So this is a three-piece Dalton Lambeth tea service. Now, it's a petite tea service, so three pieces, but the teapot was small. It's almost like a bachelor set. So a small teapot, a small sugar bowl, and a small milk jug or creamer. But what was really nice about this is it was incised with Australian fauna of kangaroos and emus amongst native foliage. And this was done by Hannah Barlow. And on the base, it was inscribed with her monogram HBB. Now, what's really nice about this is, despite that the teapot lid was missing, and there was a crack in it, the Australian motifs really played to the market. And despite having a very modest guide of $300 to $500, end up selling after around about 4 minutes of auctioning. It sold for $3,600. So a true collector's piece there. So a combination of a piece by Hannah Barlow, but also with Australiana themes. Now, Cataroo. So if you've ever come across a caricature or a cartoon cat called Cataroo, this was designed by David Henry Souter. You'll see comics, not necessarily comics, but you'll see books by Souter with Cataroo on it. Look it up. It's spelt with a K, so K-A-T-E-R-O-O. And this was figure HN154, an early model, so model number 214, so an early model for Dalton. These are quite rare. This was originally modelled by Charles Noak, one of the more famous modellers for Dalton of the period, which is around about 1906. And this sold for $4,100. Now, the other piece I'd like to talk about is the Dalton Burslem vellum ware. Vellum ware is quite unusual. It's really nice to feel. So it's got a sort of a what I'd call a dusty glaze over it. It's cream ware. It's glazed china, but it has this really nice feel, almost like running your fingers over vellum, hence the description. And this was, the figurine was done around about 1893, depicting St. Mark's Birds, which is a classical period woman feeding doves. And this was designed by Charles Noak, has a brown mark to the base, Dalton Burslem, with impressed mark Noak, 43 centimetres high, and that sold for $2,900. And finally, going back to some music, there's a polyphone. So it's a Lockman original polyphone. So the slight differences there between the symphonium and the polyphone. The method is the same, clockwork mechanism, and it plays small discs. The discs are perforated. What made this one really special, underneath the 17-inch disc sat 8 percussion bells. So not only did you have the combs that played like a piano would play, but you also had 8 percussion bells. A really nice piece. Inside was decorated with an image of the Rialto Bridge. This is all done around about 1895. Came with 36 discs, and it sold for $3,300. Okay, and that's it for that edition of Around the Auction Room. Quite amazing to see what things do sell for. As I said earlier on, even doing this after 30 years, we still get surprised by the market. So I implore you to educate yourself. Go down to either your local antique dealers or the auction room. Have a look at what's coming up for sale. Go online, do a little bit of research and see what the items sell for. All right, let's talk sterling silver. A bit of an educational here. We hear people say, I've got a silver tea set. But what does that actually mean? So silver comes in many forms. So you can have EPNS, which is electroplated nickel silver. You can have Britannia silver. People sometimes mistake pewter for silver. But silver, as we would call it, is hallmarked 925 silver. So sterling silver. So what is sterling silver? Sterling silver is 925 parts per thousand of silver. It's an alloy. Because silver, when it's melted down, rolled out, is really pliable, very easy to work, but doesn't hold its form really well unless it's mixed in with other substances. So we use the term 925 silver. That's an English term. So here in Australia, we have the same 925 parts. Other countries will have different mixes that they allow. So continental silver is around about 800 silver. Sometimes you get 850 silver, so 850 parts. So what you're buying there is essentially less silver. Whilst it is still silver, there's less silver in the overall mix there. So 925 parts silver or 925 silver or sterling silver. They all mean the same thing. Don't confuse that with EPNS or electroplated nickel silver. That's essentially a base metal. And then it's got a very, very fine coating, which is applied in a bath. Very, very fine coating of silver over the top. Nowhere near the same value. Still interesting, but nowhere near the same value. So anyway, sterling silver. How do we tell something sterling silver? You might have come across this term, a hallmark. So a hallmark is a stamp that's applied by an assay office. And that guarantees you as a buyer, certainly if you're in the 18th century, 19th century, even the 17th century, that you were buying something that was 925 parts silver. Some of the more devious silversmiths might have shorted you and put in only 850 parts or even 800 parts. And how would you really tell? You wouldn't. So they decreed, the guilds decreed, that an assay office would be set up in some of the major towns in England, and they would be the independent testers, and they were able to then stamp each of the pieces. So not only do you have the maker's stamp, the silversmith stamp on a piece, typically you'd also have the assay office stamps, and these are called hallmarks. So you'd have that it's silver, so it'd have the rampant lion, which is usually the first mark. It would then have the city stamp, so the assay office might be based in London or Sheffield, might be placed in Glasgow, and each of those offices had its own stamp. So you could say that this piece was made in London, and then it would have a year stamp on it. And so you could say that once you learnt how to read the hallmark, that this piece was made in London in 1835. So we got a small book that we used to look that up. There's lots of information online about hallmarks as well. Sometimes they also add a monarch mark as well, a monarch mark. Say that three times. So you might have for 1838, the head of Queen Victoria on there. And so that then guaranteed even further, because some of the marks, when you look at them, they use the year code, they use the alphabet, so A through Z typically, and it's inside a shaped shield. And the letters will rotate through A to Z, then the next lot A to Z. The shield shape itself would change, and sometimes the font would change. But there are a lot of similarities between some of the years, so you can have two A's that look very, very similar, and so we always go to the monarch, and sort of it's either Georgian or it's Victorian, and then it's much easier to tell that it's either 1838 or 1752. So anyway, that's a little bit of information about hallmarks. Sometimes the cheeky silversmiths who are producing EPNS works would create something that looks like a hallmark, but it'd have the term EPNS in there. So don't be confused about that. Have a look online for hallmarks, Google hallmarks or Google silver hallmarks. Have a look online and just get the understanding and feeling. You never know. You might be in an op shop one day or might be in an auction room one day and discover something that's sterling silver and buy yourself a bargain. Anyway, that's it on hallmarks and sterling silver. Hope you enjoyed. Okay, indulge me while I do some shameless advertising for some forthcoming sales for Scammel Auctions. Firstly, every Monday at 9 a.m. we kick off our estate sale, around about 950 lots. The catalogue goes online every Friday night around 7 p.m. As I said, 950 lots. Inspection is every Saturday 9 till 12, and that's in our auction room at 7 Chapel Street at Norwood. We're also calling out for entries for our forthcoming Great Collection Collector's Auction. This is going to be held on Saturday, the 31st of August. The Great Collector's Auction, Man Cave Collectibles, everything oil. We've got some maritime items. We've got some fabulous signs, some big early Shell signs that are worth about $8,000 to $10,000 a piece. We also have a 1955, 1956 Ovalback Volkswagen up for sale. And this has been restored around about 20 years ago. Great piece. I had one of those when I was young, bought it for $1,500. Really cool little car, the Volkswagen Ovalback. Anyway, that sale comes up on Saturday, the 31st of August, the Great Collector's Auction. All of our catalogues and sales are online at www.scammels.com.au. That's two M's and two L's, S-C-A-M-M-E-L-L, Scammel Auctions. And that's been the first edition of the Antique Show podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. I had a great time putting it together. I know Mark's sitting in front of me behind the window in the producer's booth. He's smiling from ear to ear. We've conquered our first one. Stick with us. Every Friday, we'll be releasing a new podcast, The Antique Show. Search online. You can find it at all the good places podcasts are kept. But don't forget to go online at two of our sites, learnantiques.com.au and scammelauctions.com. They're our sponsors. Also, I own them. Make sure there's full disclosure there, Jason. Anyway, have an awesome weekend. Learn a lot. Read all the books you can and be good to your family. That's The Antique Show, brought to you by Scammel Auctions, and is produced by Antique Education Proprietary Limited, and features on learnantiques.com and the podcast Podbean for The Antique Show. Copyright 2019.